Where were you in 1905? Well, in case you weren't around then, let me remind you about some of the things that were going on. It was the year the Wright brothers were building airplanes. Sigmund Freud was formulating his idea of the human psyche. Percival Lowell predicted the existence of Pluto. And a young unknown German physicist named Albert Einstein wrote and published a few scientific papers that would fundamentally change the way people think about the universe. It ushered in a new era of physics. And for this hour, a century after Einstein's miracle year, we're kicking off our year-long look at Einstein's legacy, broadcasting from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And we're going to talk about Einstein's contributions to physics in 1905 and beyond. We're going to dig a little deeper into the ideas behind relativity theory. We'll look at some of his experiments, or the experiments that have been done, a century in the making, that are putting some of his predictions to the test, and also whether NASA budget cuts. We've heard a lot about NASA budget cuts on Science Friday in the past few weeks, whether they will jeopardize those experiments. Also, why does the word Einstein equal genius? How did Einstein become central casting for scientists and for genius all the time? As it happened virtually overnight, we'll talk about a famous experiment that brought that on. And how maybe the Einstein we think of as that wizened old hair guy is the wrong vision of Einstein that we should be looking at. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. If you're right here in our studio audience, please don't be afraid to step up to that microphone. It's big, but it doesn't hurt. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. And we'd like to thank and welcome the teachers, parents, and students from Newport School in Wheaton, Maryland. Welcome to the studio audience here. Please don't be afraid to get up to that microphone. Let me introduce my guests. Barry Barish is the Linda Professor of Physics, a professor of high energy physics, and director of the LIGO Laboratory at Caltech in Pasadena. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Barish.
Thank you.
Richard Wolfson is the author of Simply Einstein, Relativity Demystified, published by W.W. Norton in 2003. Is also a video course called Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution from the Teaching Company. He's also the Benjamin F. Whistler Professor of Physics at Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Ralph Sinclair is a retired program officer in the Division of Physics at the National Science Foundation. Almost every year he does a public understanding of science lecture here. Nice to have you, Ralph. He's also senior scientific advisor at the Centro de Estudios Científicos in Valdivia, Chile. Did I get that right, or almost?
You did.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to the program, Ralph. Let's talk about Dr. Wolfson, 1905. What were the major events? What were the great papers that were published that year?
Well, depending on how you want to count, there were five or six papers.
Mm-hmm.
His doctoral thesis was published as a paper later, so that counts as two of them. But the papers really fall into three categories. There's the famous paper on relativity that everybody knows about. In fact, there were two papers on relativity. The famous E equals MC squared that everyone thinks is the heart of relativity was actually an afterthought. That was the second of the two relativity papers published that year. There were two papers, the doctoral dissertation and the subsequent paper related to it, and a second paper that dealt with a rather un-Einstein-sounding topic. Einstein worried about the behavior of sugar molecules in liquid and about the behavior of small pollen grains suspended in liquid. It doesn't sound like really high-test physics. But these papers finally laid to rest the question of whether atoms and molecules really existed. Today we take those things for granted. In 1905, there were still among the science community skeptics who believed these were abstract constructions of the human mind and didn't really exist, and Einstein laid that issue to rest.
Is that the Brownian motion?
One of them is the Brownian motion paper.
Brownian motion paper. And so how were these papers received when they were published?
Well, that's a good question. Relativity took a few years to become accepted. On the other hand, Einstein, at the time he published it, you pointed out that the gray-haired old man is not the picture we should have. He was a young father of 26 with a young child. By the later in that decade, he had become a really prominent theoretical physicist and was offered faculty positions, which he had been unable to obtain before then.
Is it true that he worked on relativity theory as he was a clerk in the patent office, opening the drawer, pulling out the paper, writing something down, closing the drawer, and when his boss came by?
He did work on it while he was at the patent office. I think the picture of Einstein as simply a clerk is a little bit mistaken, as he as he advanced through the patent office, he eventually became an expert at examining patents on electrical machinery, which is something he was particularly good at. So he was using his physics talents in the patent office. But it is true, he didn't have a faculty position. He was working at something else while he came up with relativity theory and these other papers.
And so he had two theories on relativity. The first one being in 1905 was the special theory. What was, in a nutshell, is it easy to describe what that special theory says?
It's easy to describe it in a single sentence, and it just says this. It says the way the world works, the way you discover the world, doesn't depend on your state of motion. And that's really all there is to the special theory of relativity. If you sit on an airplane and do experiments in physics, which might be as simple as eating pretzels from your airplane meal, those experiments work exactly the same way on that airplane, as long as it's moving through steady air without any turbulence, as they would here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's all relativity says. And the same thing will happen if you're going in a spaceship relative to Earth at 95% of the speed of light. And that is the essence of relativity. It simply says the laws of physics, the laws that describe how the universe works, are the same for everyone, regardless of their state of motion. And what's special about special relativity is only the fact that that statement is restricted to people, observers, physicists, whatever, who are moving uniformly. Dr. Barish can speak to the question of what happens when they're not moving uniformly.
Well, we'll take it away, Dr. Barish. How do we go from special to general relativity?
Well, Einstein, 10 years later, basically, decided to apply this theory of special relativity to gravity. There was no big crying reason at the time, because Newton's theory of gravity worked perfectly well, except for one small observation, which had to do with the way Mercury goes around the sun. And that hardly needed a new theory, but he applied special relativity to gravity and came up with a completely different theory of gravity from Newton's.
Mm-hmm. Ralph Sinclair, did he capture the imagination of the public with these theories? Or we you know, one of those old saws of relativity and Einstein, the only six people on Earth, remember that, could only understand anything he said.
12.
12, excuse me.
No, that was his famous statement,
right,
that only 12 people could follow his general right. theory, although now it's become part of the regular teaching of graduate students and even advanced undergraduates. It's just absorbed into the body of physics. But at the time, it was totally novel and required a way of thinking in physics and a mathematical sophistication that many physicists simply had to acquire.
Could you explain it to lay people? Could people understand it? Could it be explained to them?
I don't think I could. This is why we have right. Rich on the panel. He's the explainer. I have trouble. I would hack at it, say that what Einstein came up with, I think the my point, which is not necessarily the standard point in his history of science, is that what Einstein did in special and general relativity, in general relativity, was not in the cards.
It was not in the
cards. It was not in the cards. That is, a lot of things, if you don't do them, somebody else
right.
will in a few months.
Right.
And I speak from having had several thesis subjects published before I could finish them, so I just barely got a doctorate.
Uh-huh.
But if a lot of things simply are the next logical step. General relativity, to me, was not the next logical step. It was an independent creation that was simply not in the cards, and I don't know what form it would have taken if it had not been for the particular personality and thinking of Albert Einstein. There's very few things in science or technology which are, as I said, not in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein's point of view was to look to see how the very structure of space and time was affected by matter and vice versa. And this is something that had not occurred before, because Newtonian physics was sort of deadly dull. You had
yeah.
a framework, and everything took place within that framework, and there was no interaction between the two.
Barry Barish, what were some of the predictions that made this so unique?
Yeah. Well, as Ralph said, I kind of said that when I said there really weren't any big problems to solve. There was one, which was that Mercury's orbit around the sun, each time it goes around, it kind of makes a daisy pattern. It gets perturbed by the presence of the other planets and so forth. And the detailed knowledge of that orbit was somewhat different, was different than you could calculate using Newton's theory. It immediately solved that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But as a physicist, we hardly decide we need a completely new theory because there's one outstanding problem and somebody puts forward some answer that happens to solve that particular issue. So other solutions, like maybe we don't know all the planets and so forth, could have been the answer. And so it really wasn't called for, as Rolf said. It made a new prediction, and that was the dramatic one. It predicted that light bends in the presence of massive objects, and that was tested 3 years later and basically was a very visible and famous experiment. It made a third prediction, which is the one that I'm working on, which is that gravity sends its information from me to you, from me to someone else, from a star to us, at finite velocity. And that prediction was not part of Newton's theory. When the apple drops, you detect it immediately. And that information is carried by something called gravitational waves, and that's what we're trying 100 years later almost to actually observe.
But putting light as a finite speed created the measuring stick that you could use to do the other experiments, and that was a unique part of that prediction.
Well, I think even more so that there was a basic velocity in the universe, which I would like to call the Einstein velocity. We call it the speed of light, but it's the speed of anything. In other words, there is a limit in the universe to how fast you can transmit information or transmit a material body or whatever, and that is, it happens to be the speed of light, but it's the speed of neutrinos, it's the speed of a number of things. So let's call it the Einstein velocity, and that was something which I think Barry and Rich can correct me on this, but only began to appear as people thought about it. The fact that there was simply an upper limit to velocity in the universe, and this was not expected.
All right, we're gonna take a short break and come back and talk lots more about this and talk about some of the consequences of those predictions. My guests, Barry Barish, Richard Wolfson, and Rolf Sinclair. And our number, 1-800-989-8255. Please go to the phones, and please step up to the mic here in our hotel in Washington and ask some questions. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this year about the 100th anniversary of Einstein's special year in 1905, and coming away with some terrific published works and set Einstein on the course to becoming who he was and us to becoming who we are in science today. My guests, Barry Barish, Richard Wolfson, and Rolf Sinclair, are number 1-800-989-8255. Is it possible to sum up, Richard Wolfson, what some of the other predictions, I mean, what was so special about that was so different? I mean, what was so different than, we heard Rolf say this was a unique thing no one else could come up with. Why did he, I remember we talked about special relativity, there were people who talked about changes in size of speeds and things, when you change speeds and whatever. What was his ability to, did he have something he could think about or picture in his mind or come up with to synthesize something different than anybody else could?
I'm not sure whether Einstein had some special snap that brought general relativity on. It took him 10 years and several false starts from the 1905 special theory of relativity, which, by the way, took him only about 7 weeks to come up with after he made the sort of mental breakthrough.
Sort of thing.
He had an epiphany, and the epiphany was that time couldn't be absolute, that measures of time had to be different for different people doing the measurement. General relativity took a long time. It took a long time partly because Einstein himself had to become familiar with the mathematics it would take to describe this curved space-time, which is the essence of general relativity. So I don't know what it was about Einstein's brain that made him able to come up with this, but certainly the idea is dramatically different. In Newtonian gravity, we think of gravity as this force that reaches out across empty space, and the Earth reaches out and somehow pulls on the moon and keeps it in its orbit. And Einstein said, no, it's not even a force at all. It's simply the structure of this background, as Rolf
mentioned.
It's geometry.
Yeah.
And it is the structure of space-time. And once you accept that, then the essence of general relativity is simple. It simply says matter affects space-time. It warps it. It curves it. It gives it its geometrical structure. And then, in the words of our physics colleague Ed Taylor, space-time then gives matter its marching orders. It tells matter how to move. And that's the essential simplicity of general relativity. But there's a lot of complicated mathematics hidden in that is not in special relativity, which really is a simple theory.
Did he have to go to his friends to get the math to able to write this down?
He did get help with the math from a number of people. Even in special relativity, Hermann Minkowski, who had been one of his math teachers and had not been terribly impressed with Einstein, by the way, helped Einstein develop a sort of four-dimensional formulation to describe this thing we call space-time.
Makes all of we math students feel better that Einstein needed some help on his math, too. Let's go to the audience here. Yes.
I'm Rosalind Byrne on the faculty of the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Virginia. I have in my hands a brief one-paragraph quote attributed to Einstein. And if you wouldn't mind commenting on it, because I don't think it's the kind of quote usually attributed to Einstein. And it reads, "A human being is a part of the whole called the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation of inner security."
Any comments?
Well,
Barry?
I would just say that it demonstrates that he not only was a great scientist, but he was a human being.
Okay. Can't top that. He was a pacifist in his life. He changed his opinions about war a couple of times. He was all over the place. He talked about his views on religion. He was not an invisible scientist. In terms of where scientists are fearful these days of speaking out. And when he was asked to, and he felt strongly enough, he did speak out. Yes.
Hi, I'm Amy Schaffman. I'm from the Newport School. How did Einstein improve on Newton's laws?
Oh.
Richard, do you want to?
Rich? Well, I'll start and turn it over to my colleagues. I don't know if improve is, I guess improve is a good word to use there. Newton's laws were quite good at explaining what went on in the world of everyday experience. And in fact, I should say, implicit even in Galileo's ideas that led to Newton's laws, is the idea of relativity. And in one sense, what Einstein did was not so much to improve on those laws as to say, hey, these ideas that Galileo and Newton had, the idea that it doesn't matter whether you're moving or not, in fact, that's kind of a meaningless statement, that applies to all of physics. Physicists in the 19th century kind of thought one side of physics, electricity, magnetism, didn't obey that simple rule, but the kind of physics of the way motion works, Newton and Galileo thought did. And what Einstein did in some sense was not so much to improve on them, but to assert what they knew all along was correct for all of physics. In doing so, though, he had to give up this idea that time and space were absolutes the same for everybody. So in that sense, there's an improvement. Now, general relativity improves on Newton's theory of gravity in ways that are real and have definite physical predictions, and I'll let Dr. Barish comment on that.
Yeah. First, I'd like to say that we're paying a tribute to a fantastic scientist in Einstein. Newton, equivalently, was a great scientist, maybe the greatest of all time. So it's not that Newton was wrong some way. He solved almost all the problems of his day, and it lasted for several hundred years. The one problem in Newton's theory that got fixed, in a sense, he couldn't have known about, and that is that when I talked about finite speed of transfer of information, that really wasn't the problem of the apple falling. You don't care about that. But when we start thinking about collapse of a star in the universe or something, we know that it takes some long time, maybe millions of light years, for information to get to us. And so Einstein, who basically, you heard, basically looked at space-time or geometry as a different way of doing, of understanding gravity, enabled us to understand aspects of gravity that happen in the universe and outside that couldn't have been explained in Newton's theory. Much of what Newton said empirically is correct. What we see in everyday life is correct. So what he helped us do is understand how to apply his new theory of gravity to observations in the universe primarily.
For example, thank you for the question. For example, you're working on gravity waves, I'm detecting gravity waves. Einstein predicted violent events in motions by massive objects would produce gravity waves. Newton had nothing that would ever even predict anything like that, right?
Exactly.
Tell us about these experiments to detect these. This is one of the hottest areas of cosmology now.
Yeah. Well, as I said, the information is passed to us at the speed of light, but the next question is, what is the carrier of that information? And just as the carrier of information when you play your radio is electromagnetic waves, or when you observe the sun is light waves, the gravity, when something happens, two stars collide or something, are transmitted in Einstein's theory by something we call gravitational waves. They move at the speed of light. They're actually distortions of space-time moving through space at the speed of light.
Well, let me just stop you there to get a mental picture. If we take a rope and we shake it and we get a wave coming out of that rope, is that rope then actually space being distorted and waving up and down like that? The space itself waves up and down?
In the sense that the rope is the object that you're talking about, it's getting distorted.
Right.
So space itself gets distorted, and that propagates through space. If you throw a pebble in a pond,
right,
and you see the little waves come out, that's a distortion in that space.
And that in the space we talk about would be outer space in this case.
In this case, passing from them to us, and it's carrying the message.
And so you're trying to find those distortions?
Yeah, those distortions. It turns out that although all of us experience gravity in everyday life, we're held here on the Earth, we jump up and we're pulled down, it's the weakest of the forces in nature. We're held together by nuclear forces. Electromagnetic forces make radios work and so forth. This is the weakest. And so the actual effect when it comes, this signal, is incredibly small. The distortions of space-time are incredibly small. And it's taken us almost 100 years to develop the ideas and the technology to where we can actually hope to directly observe them.
And what kind of, do you use a telescope? What does your instrument look like?
We use a new kind of telescope. It's a telescope that, let me step back one bit, and that is, what happens if this gravitational wave comes through us? It has the effect of making us slightly taller and slightly skinnier, and then slightly fatter and slightly shorter.
It's like
and
it a goes wave back going and up
forth.
And down.
Yeah. And so what we do is try to measure this very small change of length, and we do it with what's the most delicate scientific instrument to do that, something called an interferometer, made very specially for this purpose. And it's two very large scientific installations that we've put together, one in Louisiana, and the other in the state of Washington, that we asked to simultaneously see this effect. The reason there's two is to be sure of what we see, because from outer space, the signal will get to both of them at the same time.
Now, there's a project called LISA to put these detectors in outer space, right?
Yes. So one could, of course, if I'm sitting in outer space, I also will see the signals that come along. On the Earth's surface, we are able to see gravitational waves or observe them in the region of experimentation where the Earth is quiet. And it turns out we know where it's quiet. It's where the ears work. So we basically can detect gravitational waves in the same band that the ears are sensitive. If we wanted to see gravitational waves at much lower frequency, for example, then we go to space. And that is a project called LISA. It's about 10 years away, and it's a NASA project.
Its budget is getting drastically cut.
Well, it's getting, at least it survives. It's getting...
It's on life support.
It's on life support, as many other science projects right now.
NASA has decided that it's not funding science projects these days. It's going to the moon and Mars instead.
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm Daniel Manzella from the Newport School. And I've heard that Einstein didn't believe in black holes, even though his studies sort of predicted him. And I was wondering if this was true, and if it is, why?
Did Einstein? No finger pointing. Richard, why don't you do that one?
I remember taking a general relativity course in college. My roommate, who's now an astrophysicist, and I convinced a professor to teach us general relativity, and none of us knew anything about it. And we got an ancient book, which... had in it the equations that lead to black holes, and this book said this is probably just a mathematical artifact. I think when black holes were first predicted by the equations, there were people who didn't think there could really be such objects. And it was actually J. Robert Oppenheimer, better known as the father of the nuclear bomb, who was one of the first people to work seriously on black holes. I should go back earlier. Laplace in the 1700s also predicted something like black holes using Newtonian physics. And in my own evolution as a physicist, I've gone from seeing black holes to being something that people knew general relativity said could exist but were very skeptical about, to the point where I go to astronomical society meetings nowadays and it's very obvious that there are black holes in the center of galaxies and there are black holes around individual stars within the galaxies, and black holes are pretty much everywhere. So by now they're pretty ubiquitous. And I think that's true of a lot of predictions of Einstein's, that originally they were greeted with some skepticism, and now they've become sort of working tools of astrophysicists particularly.
We're talking about Einstein this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Well, let me just follow up a second. When you say predictions of Einstein, did he write a paper and say there should be black holes out there, or did others say this is what your equations predict? Gee, maybe you should go try to prove your equations by looking for the things that make these predictions.
In the case of black holes particularly, it was a man named Schwarzschild who, in just a year or so after Einstein's equations came out, actually solved them for the simple case of a spherical star-like thing and came upon this discovery that there was this singular situation that could occur, became a black hole.
So a lot of people said, I'll take these things and we'll make, see if these things actually predict
them. Interestingly, for gravitational waves, Einstein did predict them, but thought they'd probably never be seen, which is the same story that you see something but can't see how it would be. So as smart as he was, he couldn't see how science would evolve to see black holes or gravitational waves.
But he got dark energy, didn't he? Ralph?
But he wasn't sure about that.
I've got to comment that a lot of times you'll find things predicted, but the question is, does nature elect to use that prediction? We have, for example, magnetic monopoles, which is not the subject of our present talk, but that's something that could exist but seems not to.
A monopole being something with only one pole as a
that's right, north or like south. A north magnetic pole. Or we find magnetic poles together. We never find a free magnetic pole. Nature seems not to elect to use that possibility. The same thing with black holes. They were there in the equations from the beginning, but up until the 60s and 70s, a number of people resisted invoking them because they said there was no reason to invoke them, that there was no compelling experimental evidence, till finally the evidence began to pile up. Mm-hmm. And you could say the same thing with gravitational waves. You can argue they should be there theoretically, but it's necessary to mount a very, very careful search to be able to see the universe in this new type of radiation, which will tell you where mass is and how mass is moving, much like optical telescopes tell us where shiny things are.
Did he predict time going backwards? Would relativity do that? That you could have time run backwards? Because, physicists talk about today that it's not impossible that time could run backwards. But just wondering if that was one of his predictions or came later or something else. While you're thinking about that, we'll have to take a break.
Think about that one.
We'll take some more questions from our audience. Maybe we have time for one more quick one.
I'm Megan Cooley Klein from the Newport School, and my question is, what was Einstein's role in World War II?
That was essentially zero. Einstein basically stopped scientific work in the mid-1920s and attempted to continue an idea of his, which is to unify the forces of nature into one composite idea, but really had no success on that. So by the time World War II came up, he was really had retired from active scientific work. He did two things. One, he let his name be used on a letter to President Franklin Roosevelt to alert him to the possibility of nuclear weapons. And this letter was actually written by Leo Szilard and who else was in on that?
Wigner and Teller.
Wigner, Teller, and Szilard. So three people went out to Einstein and said, please, this is an important thing. Nobody will listen to us. Will you lend your name to it? So he wrote a letter to President Roosevelt, signed it A. Einstein, telling him that that coming out of the laboratory was the possibility of incredible explosive force in nuclear weapons. That was the last thing he did. He did nothing further on that. He was not a consultant to the Manhattan Project or anything. He started it off, and then I guess...
Ralph, we got to take a break, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Einstein's miracle year with my guests, Barry Barish, Richard Wolfson, and Ralph Sinclair. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Now, we talked about Einstein working in obscurity and really being an unknown, first a patent clerk and then a professor of physics. But there was, Ralph, there was that one turning point in his career where he became an experiment, and we talked a bit about the eclipse, right, almost virtually overnight, a celebrity.
That was the 1919 eclipse. He had predicted in 1916 that light from a star, for example, passing the sun, would be bent a little bit in his path. It would not follow a straight line, but would follow his idea of curved space, curved by the mass of the sun, so that the light would curve a little bit, and the star would not seem to be in just the place it would otherwise be. You had to wait for an eclipse of the sun to come, because you can't see stars next to the sun in the daytime. So you wait for the moon to conveniently block out the sun. Then you measure the star positions. You come back 6 months later and measure them with the sun away and see if there's any difference. And in 1919, they had the it was the first attempt at international science after World War I.
Didn't some people try to go out during the war? I heard the story that someone had tried to see an eclipse during the war and got put in prison. They were captured by...
I hadn't heard that one.
I heard
it's
that
possible.
One.
But in 1919, they did the experiment. A British group did it, found the effect that Einstein predicted. This hit the newspapers, and for reasons that are a little bit hard to fathom at this point, Einstein suddenly became the world's most famous scientist because of this prediction of a totally unlikely event that then happened. Mm-hmm. And so he became suddenly, but by 1920, 1921, a public lecture by Einstein would be sold out. The room would be packed. Mm-hmm. There was one he gave in Vienna in January of 1921 in which Einstein basically mumbled at the blackboard for an hour on general relativity, and nobody in the... I've got this about fourth hand, but nobody in the audience began to understand them, but they all felt they were in the presence of greatness.
Right.
And that in itself was enough. So he, at that point, became the icon for science. And the middle-aged Einstein, the elderly Einstein, gradually became the character that you see now as a caricature, you know, bushy hair, mustache and everything. And when you see that, you know, science. Just like if you see an apple falling, you think Newton. But the apple could be on somebody's head and you think William Tell. So it's not a unique icon. But the face of the elderly Einstein is the icon for the absent-minded genius.
And that image of, gee, science is terrific, has never been equaled again. Of the year.
I think the face of the young Robert Oppenheimer at age 29 when the veil of secrecy came off Los Alamos, that was another face that people suddenly looked at and said, good heavens, what is this? You know, but that has faded. But the face of Einstein persists.
And how did he greet that celebrity? Did he welcome it? Did he shun it?
He certainly did not shun it. I don't know the middle of his life that well.
Yeah.
I could perhaps defer to Rich on that one as to whether how he regretted some things in it, like his ability to write President Roosevelt and start the American nuclear weapons program, that he lived to regret.
Right.
But that was his one contribution to World War II that I started to talk about. But I think the rest of it, he seemed in equilibrium with it, as far as I can see. He sort of clowned around a bit at times, which is a bit unfortunate. There's some very unfortunate snapshots of Einstein floating around.
And we heard all about his private life, like I would today, his socks, his violin playing, that would come with the celebrity. Yes, ma'am, a question here from the audience.
Hi, thank you very much. This has been very enjoyable. My name is Andrea Stith, and I'm from Arlington, Virginia. And I'm listening to you talk about Einstein, and you know, we accept very well the theory of general relativity now. And I was wondering if there, in the 100 years since the theory was created, if there have been any significant challenges to his theory, and was he called to defend them,
Oh, yes. There's been continual theoretical probing of the whole idea of general relativity. As one example, back in the 1960s, Bob Dickey at Princeton came up with the Brown-Dickey theory, which he felt was a superior theory of gravity. He finally, after some few years of very careful experimental checking, said that his theory was not as good as general relativity, and he withdrew it. And people are constantly probing, both theoretically and experimentally checking to see, because any little deviation way, way out there in the measurement could be telling you something terribly important. So it has stood so far, but there, as we speak, there is a conference in Germany, in Potsdam, whose title is Will Relativity Last Another 100 Years? So it's a very serious question.
Because it has never been united with quantum mechanics.
For example.
Right? And its gravity has not ever been quantized to the effect that it could be united. It's still a great mystery how to do that.
So there still may be another theory behind it, as marvelous in its own way as general relativity was when we found it behind Newton's theory.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Peter in Houston. Is it Houston, Minnesota?
Yes. Am I on the air?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello. Okay. At the age of about five, that would be about 1926, I was attending a Sunday school class at the Riverside Church, and appeared one day Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the pastor, the first pastor, and this guy with fuzzy hair, Albert Einstein, who, a charming fellow, he went to the, I was about five, remind you, he went to the blackboard and with a bunch of stick figures taught us the theory of relativity. A lot of stick figures. He had a train going 60 miles an hour, and got a little stick figure with a gun. Where would the guy have to point his gun to intersect that train going 60 miles an hour? How fast would a fly in the dining car have to fly to keep up with the train? That kind of thing. It was lovely. It was charming. After this stint at the blackboard, I had a chance to talk to Einstein and Fosdick, and I asked kid questions about religion. You know, why couldn't we see God and so on and so forth? And the replies I got seemed to me to be equivocal, and I became dubious about the truth-telling capacities of adults, and I remained a skeptic ever since. In fact, I tell my family that I became an atheist at that point, although, of course, I didn't know the word. But it was important to point out that Einstein became a Christian and remained an associate of Fosdick's for a long time, until he died, I suppose.
I never heard that version of Einstein becoming a Christian before.
Yes, he did become a Christian. He was a member of the church, and he was an associate of Fosdick's.
All right, and let me get a reaction. Anybody, Ralph?
I never heard that. That certainly would figure in any biography of Einstein, and I haven't noted that.
He did. He had some view about religion.
I think Einstein was a very religious man, but in a very unconventional sense. If you probe his notion of God, it varies from almost lack of God to a term meaning some kind of vital force throughout the universe, that kind of thing. He did not, certainly to my knowledge, embrace any of the traditional religions, although he had been raised in the Jewish tradition. He actually went to a Catholic school as a young child, but he had a very, holistic kind of view of the universe, which I would consider to be very religious, without his adopting any particular dogma or subscribing to any conventional religion.
I think he probably would not have conflicted with Dr. Fosdick, for example, on any points. So he might seemingly have, you know, been in agreement with him.
Let's go to the audience. Yes.
Hi, I'm Tracy Betzock, and I go to the Newport School. You talked earlier about how Einstein should not just be seen as a scientist, but also how he was as a person. But how much of his life did he devote to science and his theories?
Well, I would think up until the mid-1920s, it was basically a more than full-time job, because when he was working in the 1910-15-20 period, that was a very, very intensive period of work for him. He gradually began to relax, as all of us do as we tend to age, and we lose that that graduate student mentality of working 21 hours a day. But I would think by the 1920s he began to relax and to enjoy a deeper and richer life than just simply trying to focus on his physics. Mm-hmm. And except for one bit of work in the 1930s, he basically stopped doing science.
Mm-hmm. Is there a question, is there anything that general relativity cannot easily explain? I mean, are there questions still waiting about the shape of the universe, the size, whatever? Barry?
Well, there's always new problems. And I think when someone asked whether this theory will survive 100 years, we haven't really tested it yet. What we've seen is some
years,
general. We've seen some general. The next 100 years.
Next 100 years.
We've seen some general features, but we know the details of the theory. We have to have somewhere where the gravity is so strong that we can really test it, and the final theory may be very different than that. So, we haven't tested it very well. We do have some puzzles, and even new ones. And the puzzle, the main puzzle that's on the minds of physicists or astronomers or astrophysicists, has to do with the fact that we've, in the last decade, seen a very, very surprising result about something that we have been trying to understand, and that's what we call the expansion of the universe. So the universe is expanding. We've had questions of whether the expansion is slowing down, whether it keeps expanding at the same speed. We finally gotten to where we can make observations of how it's expanding, and then we hit a surprise. It's actually accelerating the expansion. And that might relate to something that Einstein once wrote down, that he discarded. It may be something very, very different. It's very puzzling, and it's probably the biggest new puzzle in science, that we solve one question and then we move on to another really big problem.
But it's
dark energy.
But that's an old new puzzle. Einstein had thought that he would put that constant in his equation, called it the biggest mistake of his career. And now we find we're putting it back in again.
Well, if that's the answer to it, there's many other possible reasons. We don't really understand enough yet to know whether it has anything to do with that constant or it's something completely different.
Talking about Einstein this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. My pet theory is that there's another universe next to us. That's something else. Yes, sir.
I'm John Houck from Oklahoma City. Supposedly Einstein said that God doesn't play with dice. And this has been used by creationists in their efforts to discredit theories of evolution. Did he really say that? And is that being misconstrued?
I think that's being taken out of context. What he meant was, as I understand it, that he was very unhappy with the formulations of quantum mechanics that began to develop in the mid-1920s. That there seemed to be a random element. If you had a particular atom, for example, it was random if it was going to decay in the next second or the next second after that or the second after that. There seemed to be no way to predict some very basic behavior at the level of the atom. And the way you got the right answer was basically by throwing dice in a mental sense to determine what was going to happen next. That was a probabilistic argument, not a certain argument. And Einstein was very unhappy with that interpretation of nature. He felt that back of that there must be hard and fast rules. So his phrase was, God does not play dice with the universe, but I think what he was referring to was the seeming probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics, which still persists. No one has found rules back of them that are governing what we see, and you get some incredibly accurate results if you go along with the dice-throwing aspect of quantum mechanics.
Would you all agree, and we touched upon it, we only have about a minute or so left, that there is going to have to be some tinkering with relativity, something bigger that this might, as we say, be a subset of?
Yeah, well, you brought up the biggest problem, and that is that relativity, we know that quantum physics is right. And what quantum physics is explaining nature at very, very short distances. And we know relativity is right, or general relativity and relativity is right. And yet there's no reconciliation of the two. We don't know how to bring them together. And it's a big problem. And one of the biggest theoretical problems we have is how to reconcile general relativity and quantum physics.
Hmm. One quick question. Yes.
Hi, my name is Abigail Tyson, and I go to the Newport School. And my question is, how did people first react to Einstein's theories and ideas?
Ralph or Richard? 30 seconds, Richard.
Right. I think that some great physicists were very impressed at first. Max Planck, who in 1900 started the quantum theory and Einstein added to it in 1905, was quite impressed with Einstein's work right from the beginning. Others were skeptical and took a while to come around.
Take another minute. Okay.
As somebody who writes about relativity for popular audiences, I get across my desk usually once a week somebody's 100-page thesis on why Einstein was wrong. Let me just follow up on this comment about will relativity change. I think we will see perhaps changes in general relativity as we merge it with quantum physics. But I think the basic idea of Einstein's, that your state of motion shouldn't matter, that everybody, it's sort of a democratic principle, that we all have equal access to the universe and the rules that govern it. I think that idea, the most essential idea of relativity, is not going to change.
Barry's talking about uniting these, you know, the two irreconcilable theories. It's going to have to take something.
But they will unite in a way that I think is consistent with that principle.
Can you give us an idea? Are you talking string theory?
I don't know. I don't personally think string theory is the answer, but I may be proven wrong in that. But I think the basic principle of relativity will be there.
But if we spend too much time on string theory, I'm going to go in a little different direction here. Could we be missing the other stuff that might be uniting it? Because that's the hot thing, is string theory, M theory, you know, the whole thing like that. Could we be barking down the wrong tree?
If we are, somebody will come along with the right idea.
All right, and we'll be here to tell you about it when they do. Thank you very much. Barry Barish, the Linda Professor of Physics, a Professor of High Energy Physics, and Director of the LIGO Laboratory at Caltech. Richard Wolfson, author of Simply Einstein, Relativity Demystified, and a video course, Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution. He's also the Benjamin Whistler Professor of Physics at Middlebury College. Ralph Sinclair, retired Program Officer, Division of Physics at the National Science Foundation, Senior Scientific Advisor at the Centro de Estudios Científicos in Valdivia, Chile. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Our technical directors are Kevin Waite and Mitch Eaton. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick in New York, Gary Henderson, Rob Byers, Argan Hutchins, Kimberly Jones in Washington. We also had help today from Brendan Banizak and Jane Holmes in Washington. If you have comments or questions, why don't you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We also have Science Friday's Kids Connection there. Click on the button that says Teachers. You can we're going to make a teaching material, free curricula out of Science Friday and out of all the Einstein material. Take it home with you, bring it into your classroom, and you can use it as teaching materials. You can also download Science Friday on your iPod and podcast it later on if you'd like to. Also, you can listen on Real Audio. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week back in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in Washington.